Hello and welcome to this edition of the Oldie Podcast. I'm Ferdy Rouse, the Oldie's editorial assistant. Today we welcome historian, travel writer and best-selling author William Dalrymple, who will talk to us about his new book, The Anarchy, The Relentless Rise of the East India Company. The book tells two stories. It explains the rise of the East India Company and the fall of the Mughal Empire, which had dominated the subcontinent for over three centuries by the time the company arrived on Indian shores. So, William, welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
So just that's a bit of context. When was the company set up and who by?
So the company was founded at a public meeting on the 24th September 1599, around the same sort of time as Shakespeare was writing Hamlet. And he was writing it in Southwark, next to the Globe, and if you'd walked just 20 minutes over London Bridge, you'd have got to Moorgate Fields, where there was a large black and white building called the Founders Hall. Founders being not kind of founding fathers in America, but the brass founders. It was an old medieval guild hall. A man called Sir Thomas Smythe, known as Customer Smythe or Auditor Smythe. The meeting had been called because there'd recently been a delegation of Dutch ship owners to London who'd wanted to buy London ships to increase their tonnage so that they could import vast quantities of Indian and East Indian spices to Europe. And this sort of ruffled the patriotic pride of Tudor London. And Smythe was determined that the English would have their own East India Company and not rely on Dutch imports. So he called a meeting in order to widen the possible capital base of the company he had in mind. He'd already founded one company called the Levant Company that was a tight-knit group of about 35 Charing Cross oligarchs, all of whom were very rich and all of whom had equal shares in the company. But the model for the East India Company was always completely different. It was always going to be a joint stock whereby anyone could invest, and even small merchants, haberdashers, skinners, vintners, these are the professions of the people who originally put in their £5 and £10. And this wasn't actually the world's first joint stock corporation, but it was probably the fourth. It was a brand new model in Tudor London as a way of raising vast sums of capital for what, in the case of the East India Company, would be a extremely risky venture. There had only ever been one previous British expedition to the East Indies, and that had ended in disaster, shipwrecked on the Moluccas. So people were being asked to invest in something that had really a pretty distant chance of success, and yet the uptake was extraordinary. Instantly, the ship owners all volunteered £1,000, £500, £300, and the poor merchants of the city were putting in fivers, tenners, and so on. And initially the company made a lot of money, but found itself outmaneuvered by their Dutch rivals, who always had more money, always had better ships, always had better captains. And at the end of the first 30 years, the company pulls out of the spice trade. And there's this famous swap that takes place between the island of Run, which is handed over to the Dutch, which is where all the world's nutmeg came from and was considered at the time to be the great prize. To keep, as a sop, in order to save face, the British are given a small muddy island in the Hudson River called Manhattan, which obviously in the long run turns out to be a rather good swap. But the British then focus on what is really the kind of second best option at that period. And that is the textile trade, the trade in chintzes, silks, cotton goods, and indigo to dye it, all of which came from one place, India. And it's that point, about 30 years into its history, that the company refocuses, not on what we today would regard as Indonesia and Java, but instead sets its sights on the trade of India. And this turns out to be an incredibly good move, because India at this point has just overtaken China as the world's principal manufacturing base. And Bengal is producing vast quantities of high quality, gorgeous textiles, which are desired not only in Europe, but further afield. There's actually deindustrialization in Mexico at this period because of the vast numbers of cotton piece goods which are being imported by the company. So in a sense, the company is from the beginning parasitic off the success of the Mughal Empire, with the difference that the, you know, we all know that Manchester was the workshop of the world in the 19th century, but we've often forgotten that the reason the company went to India was that India was the workshop of the world in the 18th century. And there were over a million weavers in Bengal producing this incredible stuff. And the success of the Mughal Empire was the generator of the profits for the early East India Company.
So what was the company's first interactions with the Mughal Empire like?
So the Mughal Empire was very centralised, extremely well-run, rich, sophisticated empire. And the company soon realised that it was going to get nowhere if it didn't have basic passes. And the only place they would get that is by going to the Mughal court in Agra. So initially, a sea captain called Captain Hawkins is sent off to negotiate, but he simply isn't sophisticated enough. He doesn't have the backing of the state. He doesn't have any of the refinements that he really needs. And so a royal expedition is mounted. The company persuades King James I to send a royal envoy with all the razzmatazz of British royalty. Sir Thomas Rowe, who's a former ambassador at the Ottoman court, who speaks good Turkish, a little Persian, who's been already an Amazon explorer, and is generally quite a man of parts, cultured, sophisticated, as cosmopolitan as any Elizabethan ever was. And he arrives in Agra after a long journey and presents a state coach. He brings with him a virginal player and a trumpeter from the court. All this is small beer compared to the magnificence of the Mughal court. And Sir Thomas Rowe quickly realises how embarrassingly poor his presents are. For example, the Mughal emperor is very happy with the coach, but instantly gives it a new trim, covers it with gorgeous Mughal cloth of gold, because the kind of Tudor textiles contained within are considered to be extremely primitive by the Mughals. And in general, Jahangir is much more interested in Sir Thomas Rowe as a sort of exotic beast, really, than actually a partner in trade. He asks him what the English drink, what strange animals they have, what curiosities there are in this distant island that he's never heard of. And the boot is very much on the Mughal foot. And there's a strange miniature which results from this meeting, by the great Mughal artist Bichita, where Jahangir is some almost godlike figure filling 4/5 of the page, and he's reaching out his hand to touch a Sufi saint as a sign of his piety, and beneath him are the monarchs of the world, and he disdains the company of the Safavid emperor, the Ottoman emperor. And most of all, tucked into a corner, a tiny image of James I, looking most sort of vinegary and sullen at being ignored. And that was very much the status of the English at the early Mughal court. They were exotic foreigners stumbling around in codpieces compared to these amazing silken Mughals who Sir Thomas Rowe describes the emperor as being fettered in gold, which is a lovely phrase, as if he's actually sort of chained up in a sort of web of gold. And very significantly, you know, Sir Thomas Rowe writes pages and pages and pages about the Mughal Emperor. The Mughal Emperor, by contrast, who writes a very voluminous diary, omits to mention the English embassy at all.
But that was the empire at its peak. 100 years later, it's a very different story. Why was it so unstable?
It wasn't unstable. It had lasted since the mid-16th century, but after 6 reigns, its hold on this vast empire, which was unprecedented in historical terms, it controlled almost all of India, all of modern Pakistan, all of modern Bangladesh, and about 3/4 of Afghanistan. And this vast state was producing well over 1/3 of the world's GDP. It had overtaken China, which is something India had never done before in its history,
yeah.
As the world's leading output of industrial production, mainly of textiles. And the first of all, the very Puritan emperor Aurangzeb alienated his Hindu army. His main strike force was really Rajputs, who were Hindu from Rajasthan. And by falling out with them and making them pay the jizya, the tax on infidels, which was an incredibly undiplomatic move, considering these people were his main strike force. Because of this, and because of overextending the empire right down to the southern tip of India, rebellions break out. First in the Maratha hills, then in the Punjab, then very much closer to Delhi. And amid all this chaos, the new emperor of Persia, a man called Nadir Shah, who's a kind of soldier who's risen to the top of the Persian army, then overthrown the old Safavid dynasty, Nadir Shah comes down from the hills to, as he puts it, pluck a few golden feathers from the Mughal peacock's tail. And he defeats the Mughals at the Battle of Karnal in 1739, and he disappears back to Persia with 8,000 wagons of loot that include the peacock throne, the Koh-i-Noor, the Darya-Noor, all the loot that the Mughals have looted from the rest of India. Nadir Shah takes back to Persia with him, leaving. It's as if the kind of fire just goes out overnight in the Mughal boiler and the whole thing disintegrates. It's as if you throw an ornate Baroque mirror out of a second floor window and just shatters into 1,000 pieces. And the forces which hoover up those little glittering fragments are the two rival East India Company. First the French, based in Pondicherry, then the English East India Company, based in Calcutta.
You mentioned the two competing companies. What gave the British East India Company the edge over the French?
Well, initially it didn't have any edge over the French, and under an extraordinary character called Dupley, the French are very much the dominant force of the two in India. They're the first to realise that you can train up local Indian warriors in the techniques of modern 18th century warfare. Just before all this is happening, you've got two huge wars in Europe, the War of the Austrian Succession and the War of the Spanish Succession, during which military tactics have been transformed, and particularly in Frederick the Great's Prussia, where all sorts of innovations with socket bayonets, elevating screws on cannons, horse artillery, infantry fighting in squares, all sorts of technical stuff, nothing, you know, sort of amazingly technologically complex, but just a whole series of manoeuvres and discipline and order, which puts this new modern trained infantry in command of any battlefield on earth. And the old Mughal cavalry-based armies, which were, you know, more or less using the same tactics that the English were using at the Battle of Crecy or Agincourt, is totally outmoded. And the Europeans realise this. Dupley, first of all, then belatedly the English. And in the first series of conflicts in the Carnatic, it looks as if the French are going to throw the British out of India. Dupley manages to make an alliance with the greatest Mughal governor in the south, the Nizam of Hyderabad, and he and his junior feudatories gang up against the English. Madras is lost, and it's at that point that a young accountant called Robert Clive flees Madras and makes it to the last British outpost in the south, which is a small fort called Fort St. David. And there Clive is trained up by a veteran of Hanoverian warfare, a man called the Old Cock, who had fought at Culloden against Bonnie Prince Charlie and so on. And Clive turns out to be this military genius. He's been wasted up to now doing what he hates, which is sort of, you know, just doing the ledgers of the company's imports and exports. And he breaks all the rules of 18th century warfare, which is a gentlemanly affair of you know, declared truces and negotiations and so on. Clive does things that are considered ruthless and slightly underhand at the time. He attacks at night. he attacks in the middle of thunderstorms or in fog in the early morning. He loves the element of surprise. He makes his troops march double speed so that people won't expect him to be where he wants to be. And he's incredibly effective. He's one of these sort of ruthless, thuggish villains who just win over less ruthless opposition. And having seen off the French in the south, he then goes and marches to the north in 1757, initially to recapture Calcutta, which has been taken by a local Nawab Siraj ad-Daulah, and to see off the French in their northern capital of Chandernagar. And he does both these things. He recaptures Calcutta, he defeats the French. And then something incredibly important happens, which really sets the tone for the next extraordinary stage of the story. Clive is contacted by a banker called the Jagat Set, which means the banker of the world. It's a title rather than a name. And this Oswald Jain Marwari banker from Nagaur in Jodhpur state, modern Rajasthan, has turned himself into the equivalent of the Rothschilds in 19th century Europe, the single richest, most powerful, most politically astute banker in the subcontinent. And he's got irritated by the bumptious Nawab of Bengal, Siraj ad-Daulah, who had attacked Calcutta. And he basically reaches out to Clive with an offer, a bribe of £2 million, if he will take an offer of £2 million, if Clive will effect what we today would call regime change, simply to overthrow the Nawab in a coup and to replace him with a man called Mir Jaffa, who's a far more pliable, uneducated Arab general. And Clive, he's a year away from his masters in London. There's no way of checking out. Just says, sure. And he travels 2 weeks north to the mangrove groves of Plassey, where there is this non-battle. The battle that was used to be taught in Victorian textbooks as the gallant foundation of the empire and the Raj was in fact a setup. The opposition general was Mir Jaffa, who stood to gain the throne if he remained quiet. So Clive just bides his time, and then by the evening, the Mir Jaffa retreats, and in the chaos that follows, Siraj ad-Daulah is overthrown and murdered, and Mir Jaffa put on the throne, and the entire contents of the Murshidabad treasury merely quickly put into boats and punted down the river to Calcutta. And overnight, this is the most dramatic sort of change of fortune. The company, from being this fragile force threatened by the French and threatened by the local Nawab, turns overnight into one of the richest companies in Europe. And Clive himself becomes the richest self-made man in Europe. Mm-hmm. It's an extraordinary windfall. And this demonstrates to the East India Company that, frankly, there's no military force in India which can stand against it. And Clive instantly realises that if he wants, he can just march up to Delhi and take over the Mughal Empire. And he writes as much to Prime Minister Pitt. Mm-hmm. Well, there's two successive battles which do this. First, there's Plassey, as I'm just describing, when you have regime change, and like with the Americans after 9/11, Afghanistan, they put in a Karzai figure who they believe that they can control. But that control becomes overt and open after a second victory a few years later in 1764 at the Battle of Buxar. And the Battle of Buxar is an incredible moment for the company. Three great Mughal leaders, the new Nawab of Bengal, Mir Qasim, the Nawab of Awadh, based in Faizabad, who controls north-central India, a giant of a man called Shuja-ud-Dawlah, and the Mughal emperor himself, Shah Alam, join forces and try to expel the company from India. And to everyone's complete surprise, the company again wins a victory against a much larger force. at the Battle of Buxar, and they capture the Mughal emperor and they defeat the other two leaders. And by this stage, there's no point the company pretending that it's representing somebody else or putting in a puppet. They now control northern India, and they do this now overtly. They still use the Mughal emperor as cover, and they claim to be the servants of the Mughal empire, but everyone knows what the true case is. And this completely transforms not just the politics of India, but the economics of the company and of Britain. Up to now, the company, like anyone that wanted to do business in India since the time of the Romans, just had to ship out bullion from Europe, gold and silver, because that's all that Indian merchants were interested in. And with it, they would buy the opium, the textiles, whatever it was they were wanting to buy. But after the Battle of Buxar, with the British installed now as the actual controllers of eastern India, northern and eastern India, all they have to do is simply tax their Indian subjects. And with the profits, they can buy the gold. And with the profits, they can buy the textiles, the opium, the tea, and anything else they fancy, and then ship it back to Europe without having to send any money out. And it's, of course, a fantastic business model, and a great deal of the beautiful 18th century houses that we visit over the weekends with our National Trust passes have not just sort of treasuries like you see at Powers Castle, full of East India Company loot taken from Tipu and Siraj Dowla and all these other Nawabs. Many of them are built on entirely on East India Company fortunes. This is the main, what I suppose the city was for the English rich in the 1980s. The East India Company was in the 1780s. And it transforms our nation's prosperity. It's not the only thing. I mean, there's also, of course, the slave trade and the Caribbean plantations, which at the same time are generating huge wealth to the West. But about a third of British imports at this point and a third of British exports come one way or another through the East India Company. And they're generating about a third of British income. They're the single largest employer in the country. They build half the London docks. And by the 1780s, they've spread right across the world. They're growing opium in India, which they're selling illegally in China. With the profits of that, they're buying tea, which they ship to India, to Europe, and also to America. And it's, of course, East India Company tea, which is dumped in Boston Harbor at the Boston Tea Party.
Mm-hmm. With the East Indies control Bengal after the Diwani, handed over by Shah Alam, that is when we first see, I suppose, true interest from the British government and the press. How important was that?
So, a very crucial thing happens next is that in 1772, due to the asset stripping of Bengal by the company, the completely unprincipled, unregulated, and frankly monstrous way that British merchants fan out across the country and force their goods on Indians at the point of a bayonet, literally. I mean, some of the best letters we have describing this are from none other than the young Warren Hastings, who at this point reads like a sort of crusading young Guardian journalist, exposing the Windrush affair or something like that. You know, he's full of moral indignation at the sheer barbarity and ruthless inhumanity of his colleagues. And what they've done is really pretty well through their own greed. They've wrung the neck of the goose laying the golden eggs. And in 1772, there is the most catastrophic famine. And the company comes close to bankruptcy. The share price collapses. 30 banks collapse like dominoes across Europe. And Parliament, which has been prorogued, has to be recalled. An enormous loan of several million pounds granted to the company. And this is the crucial moment, really, that the company moves not just from... 6 years earlier, it had moved from being a trading company from an empire of business to the business of empire. This is the moment that it moves from being this sort of libertarian wet dream of unregulated capitalism to what we, I suppose, would call a public-private partnership, just like, say, NatWest after its collapse with the subprime and all those catastrophes of a decade ago, and the way that the government, Gordon Brown's government, had to buy out half of NatWest in order to save it. So with very similar motives, the government becomes the sort of 50% shareholder in the company. And this is the moment that it begins to get regulated, and you begin to see the tone change from sort of just buccaneering, sort of, you know, land piracy. Macaulay famously wrote that the company looked on India rather as a buccaneer would look on a galleon. And this is the moment you begin to get out, you know, ideas of some responsibility to India. Up to this point, you know, the company was as blatantly about profit as Goldman Sachs is today. Mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs doesn't claim to be bringing civilization to the world or building railways, nor did the company. It's only at this period that the government begins to get involved that we begin to hear the beginning of building of colleges or roads or anything other than just seeing India as a source of profits for shareholders.
Mm-hmm. So it becomes a sort of almost semi-nationalised, effectively, the company at this point, and it obviously becomes more and more nationalised as the history progresses.
Until in 1857, it is actually formally nationalised.
Of course, yes. Yeah. But surely from this point onwards, is there not arguably a point to be said about it being close enough run by the government for it to have quite a lot of control, with the Governor General's being imposed from the government and so on, but far away enough to have deniability for the state.
You're right, exactly that. Because there continues to be what there always had been, which is a very different set of interests between the men on the ground who stand to make profits if they start wars and plunder cities, and the company and the government in England, which wants, and you get these letters being sent out over and over again, a quiet trade, they say, and you know, gradual trading profits. That's what the company wants, and that wants what, and that is what the government wants, and what there isn't, it's very interesting. There is no ever any sort of master plan for empire. There's never a moment when the company or the Governor Generals openly say, you know, we want to take India. Until the nearest you get to that is when Richard Wellesley sails out in 1798. And Richard Wellesley isn't particularly after the conquest of India for itself. What he wants to do is to remove any pockets of French influence. This, of course, is the moment when it's rather like sort of, you know, the year of the Battle of Britain, when Britain stands alone. The same happened during the Napoleonic Wars. And from about 1800, most of Britain's European allies have been defeated by Napoleon. There's a great danger of Napoleon invading England. And he does invade Ireland. At this point, Wellesley goes out very much as the government's envoy. He has never been to India, he has no East India Company background, he's got no interest in the profits of the company or anything like that. Richard Wellesley is very clear that his job is to clear all the remaining French mercenary troops out of India. And that means attacking or negotiating, first of all, with the Nizam of Hyderabad, then attacking Tipu Sultan, and finally this last cataclysmic war with the Marathas, where he puts in charge, in an act of very blatant nepotism, his kid brother Arthur, who of course is the later Duke of Wellington. And Wellington, in old age, it says that the battles he fought with the Marathas, particularly the Battle of Assaye, was the hardest fought victories of his entire campaign, and that, you know, Napoleon was a pushover compared to the Maratha artillery.
But having said that, though, French influence was in every court, as you've said. So is that not really already an imperial dream?
So, yes, I mean, French influence was in many courts. There were three French-trained mercenary armies at large with Nizam of Hyderabad and with the Marathas. And They do actually genuinely represent a risk to the interests of the East India Company, and there is communication between the mercenary commanders, the particularly the enthusiastic Jacobin, a man called Raymond, who was in charge of the Nizam of Hyderabad's troops, was very keen to coordinate a strong response to the company in support of Napoleon. And quite separately, Tipu Sultan of Mysore, this incredible self-made warlord who'd taken over great swathes of the south, is in communication with Napoleon himself. And Napoleon's landing in Egypt, which actually happens in 1798, is part of a plan that Napoleon has to go down the Red Sea and invade India from through Tipu's kingdom. So there's actually an active plan. So you know, Wellesley is not dreaming false dreams of Francophobia. He is reacting in an extremely efficient manner to a real threat. But I mean, it's a very different business to, you know, Plassey and Clive 50 years earlier. Mm-hmm. What's happening here is that the British government has effectively installed a cuckoo in the company nest, and Wellesley is using the company's private army of 200,000 troops, which incidentally by this stage is exactly double the size of the British army, and he's using that enormously powerful force to follow Britain's strategic interests rather than the commercial interests of the company.
So all along this extraordinary history that you've outlined, from Plassey to the time of Tipu towards the turn of the century, you have this extraordinary emperor, Shah Alam, who is very much the spine of your narrative. Who was he and why was he so important? What drew you to him?
So Shah Alam is this extremely attractive and tragic figure, who represents all that is most sort of melancholy about the final days of the Mughals. So the Mughal Empire had spread across India from the 1560s onwards, and at its best, under the Emperor Akbar, was this amazingly liberal tolerant and rich and sophisticated empire. Akbar welcomed to his court Jesuits from Goa, Jews from Cochin, Jains from Gujarat, Buddhists from the Himalayas, Shaivite and Vaishnav Hindus, Sunni, Shia and Sufi Muslims, and engaged them all in multi-religious discussions in his court at Fatehpur Sikri, aiming, he said, to find the firm ground of reason and avoid the marshy land of tradition. In other words, he was after finding reason and truth and to throw out superstition and eradicate it from his realms. And he does this in this extraordinary partnership with the Hindus of his reign. He defeats, then promotes to be his principal general, the main Rajput leader, the Raja of Amer, later Jaipur. And he creates a multi-religious super empire. But by the time of Shah Alam, thanks to Nadir Shah's invasion, thanks to the bigotry of Aurangzeb, and thanks to 1,000 miscalculations by his predecessors, the Mughal Empire has shattered, and it really only controls a small area around Delhi. And it's Shah Alam's dream, having seen at the age of 12 Nadir Shah loot and destroy his patrimony, it's Shalom's dream to rebuild it. And at one stage, he very nearly succeeds it. In 1772, he leaves famine-struck Bengal. He rejects the company's offers of protection and support. And he returns to Old Delhi to retake up his empire. And he has at his hand this extraordinary Persian general, this another military genius called Najaf Khan. And Najaf Khan is this superb general who defeats all the enemies of the empire, the Jats, the Sikhs, re-establishes Mughal power across the whole of the kind of Gangetic plain. Meanwhile, Shah Alam is writing poetry in five languages, welcoming miniature artists back to his court. And very briefly, it looks as if the whole empire is re-establishing itself. But when Najaf Khan dies, that whole dream disappears overnight. And Shah Alam is attacked and blinded by an Afghan warlord named Ghulam Qadir, who may well have been a former lover of the emperor. And there is a particular viciousness about this attack. Shah Alam is straddled by Ghulam Qadir, who first of all pokes out his eyes with his thumbs, and then the following day gouges out what's left with a dagger, and then sits astride him and gets one of the court painters to paint him doing it. I mean, it's a kind of terrible scene. A lot of the research in this book has taken place out of these Persian language sources, which India is very rich in. And I found that although there were accounts of this which had been translated into English before, they'd all been bowdlerized, and the original Persian ones are full of the most sort of horrific detail and threats and rape and descriptions of detailed descriptions of rape, which no Victorian would have ever allowed into his prose. It's been thoroughly bowdlerized, and I'm glad to say all the horrible, gory details are here in English for the first time in this book. So poor old Shah Alam, by the end of the book, having been this young, gallant prince rebuilding the Mughal Empire, by the end, when the British march into Delhi in 1803, he is this old man, blind, living in a ruined palace. The token emperor of an illusionary empire.
Under the Maratha protection, towards the end of his reign, after Ghulam Qadir has been killed, the Marathas take him into their protection, and there's a moment, again, where, though he won't succeed, one gets the impression that the Marathas might defeat the East India.
It's a very good question, because the technological edge that the company had over the Indian courts really only lasted about 40 years, between about sort of 1740, when the French begin training up sepoys, to 1780, when the company is badly defeated by the Marathas at the Battle of Talegaon. And from that point, there's really very little in terms of technology. Oh, there's actually very, very little in terms of technology between the Indian armies of the Marathas and Tipu Sultan and those of the company. In fact, they're you know, recruiting mercenary soldiers from the same area. They all dress in company style red coats. They've got very similar artillery, very similar muskets. Tipu arguably has better muskets and artillery than the company. So what is it that gives the company its edge? And the answer is resources, because by this stage the company has settled and brought under Cornwallis, there's this thing called the permanent settlement, where they rejiggle the land holdings of Bengal. And in that process, basically, the old Mughal aristocracy lose out. And new Hindu business classes, what people in India today call the Bhadralok of Bengal, families like the Maliks, the Debs, and the Tagores, buy up land holdings. And so you have a whole new class in Bengal who are Hindu, not Muslim, who have a stake in company rule. And particularly, you have the Hindu banking classes, who from the beginning, from the time of the Jagat Sets, have realized that the company, in a sense, is their counterpart, that they're both financiers. And while the company may be European, it may be Christian, it may be based in London, they speak exactly the same language in terms of interest rates, loans, paying on time. Plus, the company has courts where civil contracts can be defended and fought in court. And so from the very beginning, you get this feeling among the financiers that the company is, for all its many faults, the force they want to do business with. Mm-hmm, sure. And you could argue that the British East India conquest of the Mughal Empire, far from being a gallant nationalist project with the glory of empire and the bravery of British soldiers, is actually just a stitch-up between two groups of financiers.
It's very interesting you mentioned that it's it's very much seen as this national rather than corporate venture.
Well, it's not at the time. This is the important point. In the 18th century, there's absolutely no doubt in Britain
that how we see it now.
This is a corporate thing. And it's the 19th century Raj that re-spins this as the great, you know, the Union Jack unfurling magnificently over the Indian plains, who they create the rhetoric in, you know, as late as the 1880s and 1890s of, you know, bringing civilization to India, the telegraph, the railways, and what have you. And they spin over the fact that this was a corporate conquest done for, you know, without any shadow of doubt, for the profit of shareholders. And in a sense, Indian nationalist historians have bought that line too, and they see it in reverse as a story of national liberation from oppression. And the corporate nature of the conquest of India has been forgotten on both sides. And in a sense, this is the main point of the book, to remind people that this was not some national or civilizational project to, you know, to help bring railways to India. This was just asset stripping by a company trying to gain the maximum possible profit from its shareholders. And there's a wonderful quote by the Lord Chancellor at the impeachment of Warren Hastings, which is the one time, in a sense, that empire really gets put on trial in Parliament. And the Lord Chancellor says, "Corporations have neither souls to be condemned nor bodies to be punished. They therefore do as they like."
It's the one of the epigraphs of the whole book, isn't it?
Correct. And in a sense, that's what the book's about.
Of course. Yeah. I sense there's a current affairs mention in there at all.
Well, I do have a little sort of both in the introduction and in the concluding passages. I take forward this idea of how the company and its history represents not just the story of the conquest of India by this corporation, but it's also in a much wider sense this battle which is still ongoing in our own time between the power of corporations and the power of the state. And in the 19th century, with the nationalisation of the company, the East India Company story ends with the victory of the state over the corporation. The question is whether in the 21st century, whose foot is the boot on? We saw with the bank collapses of 10 years ago after the subprime crisis, how the collapse of the nationalised banks of Iceland very nearly brought down that entire country to bankruptcy. We saw the mess it inflicted on the British economy and the extraordinary effect it had on Obama's America. But it continues. This battle between the corporation and the state continues. It was the East India Company which invented corporate lobbying. And it's the East India Company which first tried to bribe parliamentarians in 1697, less than a century after the creation of the company. The company is caught offering share options to MPs in return for them voting for its the extension of its monopoly, and the governor of the company and the Lord Privy Councillor, Jacob Rees-Mogg's predecessor, end up in the Tower of London. And this is, you know, absolutely the issues of our time. I've just come back from a book tour in America where Elizabeth Warren was making these campaign speeches about controlling the power of corporations, and she was thinking of Amazon and Facebook and Google. And you can argue that, you know, on one hand you can argue, I suppose, that there's really no comparison between them and the East India Company. Not only do they not have sovereign control of any land, they don't even have armies, or, you know, for Google to be as powerful as the East India Company, surely it should have nuclear submarines and fighter jets. But you can take a different view too, which is that maybe these days they just don't need them. When we've got Google listening to this conversation through the phone in my pocket, and no doubt will be sending you ads for East India Company tea tomorrow morning in your feed, maybe they don't need armies anymore. Maybe they've got our lives so totally controlled through our own volition. Every time we put on Facebook or search for something on Google, maybe their control is nearly complete without needing to resort to force.
That's a sound thought. So I suppose, just to wrap it up, how did the East India Company end? Obviously, with 1857... But it had another 15 years to go, and longer.
So 1857, there is, well, it's a death of many cuts. In around 1830, its monopoly is taken away. So other trading companies are allowed to operate in India, and you get a lot of, particularly a lot of Scottish merchants coming in, including lots of Frasers from Inverness, coming in to trade in Calcutta. The founding of these agency houses, often with names like sort of MacKillop, Mackenzie, and Fraser, and this sort of thing. Then in 1839, I think, that sort of date, the company actually gets its own right to trade withdrawn, so that it is reduced to a sort of governing corporation, in the same way that the BBC is a corporation today that has the rights to broadcast. So the East India Company is a corporation that has the right to rule India in the name of the Crown. And finally, in 1857, after the company completely cocks up and generates the largest anti-colonial revolt to take place anywhere in the world at any point in the 19th century, which we still call the Indian Mutiny, but which in India is known as the First War of Independence. In the aftermath of that, the company reacts with such sort of horrific violence and viciousness, leading to maybe the death of 300,000 innocent civilians. I mean, and these, you know, this is the possibly the greatest colonial atrocity in history, and one that incidentally is never taught in our schools. No British child learns about the hundreds of thousands of innocents killed in 1857, and this is something we need to know. This is important and dark parts of our history that the British remain entirely ignorant of, and I think this actually has repercussions for our own time, because living in Delhi, I see endless brilliant high commissioners coming out with top Oxbridge degrees, believing that India is our best friend, this wonderful thing. You know, and it's all like some fantastic Merchant Ivory film where ladies in crinoline dresses and parasols embrace handsome Maharajas with elephants. And it's all very charming and lovely. But the reality is that most Indians today look on the British as little better than buccaneers who boarded their galleon. We need to know how rapacious other nations view us, particularly the Indians. And I think it's actually a major problem at the moment, that this sense that somehow we have this glorious past, which we're trying to recreate with Brexit, and the first thing that happened after the Brexit vote was Theresa May went to India in a plan that the civil service dubbed Empire 2.0, hoping that India and some massive trade deal with India would save us after we've fallen out with our European partners. And of course, it ain't like that. The Indians are very happy to do business, but are not going to give us any special exceptions, thanks to the Empire. And in fact, decided not to make any trade deal with Theresa May after she made it more difficult for Indians to get visas. So I actually think that by misremembering our history in India, by giving it a ridiculously positive spin and forgetting what was in large part an act of plunder and an asset stripping, because the Raj was only 90 years. Even if you have a very positive take on the Raj, it's only 1858 to 1947. For the great mass of the time the British were in India, in other words, 1599 to 1858, which is 250 years, India is governed by a commercial corporation. Mm. And that corporation doesn't make any bones about it, why it's there. It's there to make a profit. Mm. No question. It's there to get whatever it can out of India. In the same way that Goldman Sachs is there to make a profit. Nothing wrong with that. But that's the reason. So when we have this sort of benign idea that we brought railway civilization to India and India loves us because of it, that is a problem. It's not true, and India doesn't see it like that. And we just look ridiculous when we try and recreate a nostalgia which doesn't exist. So I have to say, I'm writing this book very much with a view to correcting what I think is a very whitewashed British attitude to empire, and to remind people that it's very far from the kind of sepia tinted Merchant Ivory film that we might imagine it to be.
Mm. Well, on that important note, thank you very much.
Thank you, Freddie. Thank you very much.